Thank you, David. I'm delighted to be here. So let me just get started on my talk here. One thing that I want to say is that I've been doing physics education research for about 18 years now. And some of the things that we do in physics education research is a cyclic process. So we investigate what kind of difficulties students have in learning physics. We develop and evaluate curricula that might reduce these difficulties, put them through instruction, and then see what's helping students and what is not, and this cycle continues. And all of it is based upon a model of learning. So here I have a schematic of what I call a very simplified model of learning. So in order to help students learn better, we must think about where students are at the beginning of the course. It's very important to know what is the initial knowledge state of the students, because that's what we will build on. And if this knowledge state is not kept in mind while developing instruction, then the final knowledge state that the students will get to is not necessarily going to be the optimal final knowledge state that was based upon the goals of the course. Now, it's very hard to know what students know at the beginning of the course, but you can give them some pretest, and you can interview students, and you can even look at some findings of physics education research in the papers, in the literature, and that will tell you about what are the common difficulties that students might have at the beginning of the course. And then based upon those things, you can develop your curriculum to help students learn better. And again, at the end of the curriculum, you can actually, at the end of your instruction, you can give them some post-tests and also interview some students one-on-one to see whether they the performance on those tests actually reflects what you wanted them to learn. Now, it's also very important to know that what the performance reflects about the student's final knowledge state, or even their initial knowledge state, is very strongly tied to how well those measures, those tests that you were using to measure students' knowledge, was actually reflecting the goals of your course. So if the tests are superficial, then the, you know, what you will get from them will also be superficial, and that may not be really reflecting what you're trying to help your students learn better. So let me start with a study here that I did a while ago. This was more than 10 years ago. This study involved 20 physics faculty members and a lot of introductory physics students. And in this particular study, what we were trying to look at was what role does intuition play in learning physics? Now, generally, if you look at cognitive psychology's papers related to expertise in problem solving, you will see that most of the interviews that are conducted with physics faculty members, because physics still turns out to be a very nice platform for cognitive scientists to learn about problem solving, because physics is a very knowledge-rich domain in which there is a very well-defined knowledge hierarchy, and you can easily tell who's an expert in physics and who's not, unlike, say, for example, English or something. But, no, it's true, because the thing is, it's very hard to differentiate between, you know, who's really a good writer and who's not, because there's a lot of subjectivity that comes into picture there, as opposed to in physics. And so physics is being used by cognitive psychologists. Physics and chess are two, and even mathematics is very commonly used by cognitive psychologists to actually learn, you know, to investigate problem-solving related things. One problem that I saw in those studies was that they don't really tell you anything about what happens when experts are put in situations where they don't know how to solve a problem. You know, that's what I mean by when physical intuition fails, because if experts are always given problems that are more like exercises for them, because they already know the answers to those, then if you ask them to solve those problems, they will immediately tell you, this is what I should do in this situation, and it's not really telling you anything about how would an expert solve a problem. So this problem that I gave them was a non-intuitive introductory physics problem, and it happens to be from third edition of Halliday-Resnick, and it was a third problem in chapter 12, which was actually a mathematical problem, but I turned it into a conceptual question because it turns out that this is a question whose answer is not intuitive. So what's the question? Let me give you this question and have you think about it with a person next to you to see what you would think about the think is the answer to this question. Here's the question. A wheel is spinning with some initial angular speed, omega zero, and then it falls on the ground and then slips for some time because there's some amount of friction on the surface. And then after some time, it locks in and starts to slip, it starts to roll without slipping. The question is, how does the final speed at which it starts to roll without slipping depend upon how much is the coefficient of kinetic friction on this surface? That's the question, okay? So there is some friction on the surface. How would the final speed depend upon the coefficient of friction? Just take like 15, 20 seconds to think about it with the person next to you, and then, you know, we'll discuss, you know, what should happen in this situation. In the interest of time, somebody from the last row, any thoughts on this particular problem? What might be the answer? Go ahead. Okay, that's a good thought. Thank you so much for volunteering to tell us what your group thought about it. It turns out that there is no dependence. So in other words, the fine. Well, the point is, what we found is that the physics faculty had equal amount of difficulty solving this problem, you know, as introductory physics students. You know, so in other words, this is not an easy problem because there are two critical variables that one has to think about. One is how much is the coefficient of kinetic friction. The other one is how long does it take to start rolling without slipping. You know, and if the coefficient of kinetic friction is large, it will roll without slipping faster. On the other hand, if it's small, then it'll take a long time for it to lock in, right? So the total amount of energy that is dissipated in the form of heat and all before the thing starts to roll without slipping is the same regardless of the coefficient of friction. And there are two ways to solve this. You know, you can actually use kinematics, you know, and in the end relate the fact that once it starts to roll without slipping, you know, V is equal to R omega, and you will see the coefficient of kinetic friction drops out. But more elegant way to think about it is if you think about a conservation of angular momentum about the point where the wheel touches the ground here. And you can see that the angular momentum is conserved, and hence there couldn't be a dependence on coefficient of kinetic friction. But angular momentum is a tricky thing. The reason I point this out is because this problem was something in which physics faculty were made to think on their feet, you know, in one-on-one interview. And what you saw is how they reason. And even though it was a difficult problem for them, they were more systematic in their approach. What we found is that, you know, they were thinking about doing a conceptual analysis of the problem. They were thinking about, are there principles of physics that I can use? Maybe like, you know, linear momentum conservation or energy conservation or even angular momentum conservation. The thing is, that is a tricky thing because you have to think about the point about which angular momentum is conserved. Or they even thought about limiting cases. You know, unfortunately, in this particular case, it doesn't help you if you think about the case where there's no friction, because there should be some friction in order for it to start rolling without slipping. Or, you know, infinite friction case doesn't help you either. Or they thought about making analogies. All of these things are very good problem-solving heuristics. When I say analogy, I mean, you know, you can make an analogy with pool game. You know, some faculty even talked about, what about the case where, you know, an airplane is landing and the wheel is rolling, and then it, you know, how will the friction on the surface affect the final speed? The point is, you could tell that if you had given this problem and said, okay, think about it this evening, tell me the answer in the morning, they would have come up with an answer, because they were thinking in systematic ways, something that we should really help our students do explicitly. Because this is not something that comes automatically to students, because in one-on-one interview, we could see that the students were kind of going in circles often. They were not using any systematic approach, because that is something that you have to teach them along with the physics content that you're teaching them. But the second thing that we learned here is that the intuition that you have built about something plays a very important role in whether you think the problem is easy or difficult, because no physics professor found this problem easy. On the other hand, we actually, in the same interview, asked them to also do another problem, which was about ballistic pendulum, in which, you know, you have two putties, one goes to a certain height, let go, you know, it comes, collides, and sticks with the other one, and then they go up together, and you ask them, what's the final height in terms of initial height of this thing, right? If these things are of the same mass. You can imagine physics professors were like instantaneous. Even before reading the whole problem, they told you the answer. They're like, oh, you would use conservation of mechanical energy, conservation of momentum when the things collide, and conservation of mechanical energy when the things go up. But for introductory physics students, can you guess? This problem was extremely hard. In fact, we gave this problem to about 2,000 students from 14 different universities in the multiple choice format also, in addition to giving it in open free response format at University of Pittsburgh. And what we found is that after instruction, when students were asked which of the principles would you use, only 27% of the students provided correct answer. And in fact, at all of these places, students were also asked to guess the answer at the beginning of the course, just as a pretest, because we just wanted to see how they would guess. And they did slightly better than this just by guessing at the beginning of the semester. So you can see that despite the fact that many of the faculty members were confident that, oh, this problem was pretty much covered, I actually went through this, and my students should be able to do it, students' performance is not very good. Some students are thinking that only one principle should be used, all the other one, but not both of these principles. And you can see how difficult this problem is if you really try to put yourself in students' shoes, because there are three sub-problems to this, which are temporally separated. And it's not very easy for students to actually think about all of those different parts. Maybe for you as an expert, this is an obvious problem, but for your students, it's not. So one of the lessons that I also want people to think about from this particular study is that the perceived difficulty of the problem not only depends upon the inherent complexity of the problem, but also about on the experience, familiarity, and intuition that the person has built about these things, okay? And so you must assess the difficulty of a problem not from your own perspective, but you have to put yourself in your student's shoes, think about their initial knowledge, and then think about how to teach these things from their perspective, not from your own perspective, because otherwise it could even be that there will be, the knowledge transfer is not going to be optimal, right? So there needs to be this impedance matching based upon what difficulties students are having and based upon how difficult the problem is from their perspective. So let me now move on to talking about quantum mechanics teaching and learning, something that I have been very interested in also, and you all know that quantum mechanics is not an intuitive subject at all, right? So because all of the things in quantum mechanics, first of all, people don't have everyday experience dealing with these kinds of things. Then you have, position and momentum, and you thought that you had just learned about these things, and you actually, for once, have Newtonian views of these things after you have taken classical mechanics, and here you come to a quantum mechanics class, suddenly all those things go out of the window. Now position and momentum are just some operators that act on states in Hilbert space, right? They're not deterministic state variables the way you had learned it in classical mechanics. So just like in introductory physics, all those everyday experience things, start interfering with your learning, and give you misconceptions. Now there is interference going on between what you learned in classical mechanics and what you're learning in quantum mechanics, right? Because things are actually totally different. The framework is completely different. Unfortunately, in Hilbert space, no one can hear you scream. So the thing is, one of the things that we have been very interested in are difficulties and misconceptions that students have in these quantum mechanics courses similar in nature to the difficulties that introductory physics students have in introductory physics? And can the difficulties be correlated with the teaching style or place of study and textbook, etc.? And also, we want to, after investigating these difficulties, we have been very interested in developing learning tools such as quantum interactive learning tutorials or quills and tools for peer instruction. And of course, these tools are based upon research on difficulties and also learning theory, cognitive theory. All of these tools are designed to keep students actively engaged in the learning process. They bridge the gap between the formalism and conceptual aspects of quantum mechanics, and they build on the prior knowledge of students. And they also often exploit computer simulations to help students build intuition about these quantum processes. So let me give you a couple of examples of the difficulties that we found in our investigation. And by the way, these investigations were done with several hundred students, not just from University of Pittsburgh, but from several different universities, 7-8 universities across the United States. And one of the questions was, for example, this was given to first-year graduate student at the beginning of their course. the question was asking, is H psi is equal to E psi always true for all of the possible wave functions, or is it only true for some of the wave functions? And if so, you know, you have to explain your reasoning for what, why that is the case. And the correct answer here is that this statement is only true for the stationary state or energy eigenstates. And if you have a linear superposition of stationary states, then this statement is not true. So, for example, if you can see, if psi was equal to psi 1 plus psi 2, where psi 1 and psi 2 are ground states and first excited state, this is not going to be true because you have E1 and E2 and you cannot pull E out. Unfortunately, you can see that only 29% of the students provide correct response. And so this is a very difficult question because most of the time people say this statement is always true. What you find is that what is amazing is that in one-on-one interview, even if you say, can you tell me in the particular context of this psi 1 plus psi 2? And even then people say, it's still true because, you know, each of them satisfies time-independent Schrodinger equation, so the sum should satisfy it too. So only when students are explicitly asked to write down and show things, then they realize that maybe there is some discrepancy, but it's a very difficult question, and many students agree with this statement. Now, similarly, if you ask students, okay, here you have a state which is a linear superposition of the ground state and the first excited state wave function like this, the question is, what is the wave function after time t? This turns out to be a very hard question also, and only 43% of the students, you know, either first-year graduate students or advanced undergraduate students provide the correct response. And the correct answer here will be that the time-dependent phase factor here will be e to the power minus I E1 t over h bar, here e to the power minus I E2 t over h bar. By the way, here actually the question was asking, is the probability density time-dependent or not? And you can see that here the probability density is time-dependent because the phase factors are not the same for the two terms, and hence there are cross terms. Now, again, you can see that more than 50% of the students have difficulty answering this question, and many of them actually put a common time-dependent phase factors in order to find the time dependence. Okay, by the way, in this question, we had also asked students, what are the possible values of energy you can measure in this, and what is the expectation value of energy? What we found is that what possible values of energy you can find, people did a lot better on that question than what is the expectation value of energy. Now, if you think physically about this question of what is the expectation value of energy, and if you think of this as an average value of energy measured, you know, when you have a large number of identically prepared systems, right? If you do the measurement of energy on those and you average it, then you would say, oh, expectation value is just the average value of large number of measurements on identically prepared systems. Unfortunately, that's not the way most people try to answer that question. And that, on that question, again, the performance was something like 40% correct answer for the second part in which they had to find the expectation value, because a majority of students tried a formulaic approach where they said, I'm going to do psi star h psi. And, of course, you have to do an integral there, and many people got lost in orthogonality of these things, or some people forgot to write the integral there. You can see that that's a much more involved approach, even though you can use that. So the response there was not much better either. This was one of the questions too, where the question is asking about quantum measurement. And you can see that quantum measurement is a weird thing, right? And what is taught to students in all of the undergraduate and graduate courses is the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. That's what we teach, in which time measurement is something that is, you know, abrupt and different from time development of wave function. So we say, okay, so the most fundamental equation of quantum mechanics is time-dependent Schrodinger equation, but then when measurement takes place, the state suddenly collapses to an eigenstate of the operator corresponding to the observable that you're measuring. So basically, this question was asking, consider the following conversation between two students about the measurement of an observable Q for a system in the state psi, which happens not to be in an eigenstate of this operator Q hat that corresponds to this. So Andy says, when an operator Q hat corresponding to a physical observable acts on the state psi, it corresponds to a measurement of that observable. Therefore, Q hat acting on psi must give you an eigenvalue, Qn, times the same state back. Caroline says, no, that's not correct. Measurement collapses the state, so Q hat acting on psi will be Qn times psi n, where psi n on the right-hand side of the equation is the eigenstate of q hat with eigenvalue qn. With whom do you agree? It turns out both of these students are incorrect, because the correct thing here is that, you know, if psi is not an eigenstate, then psi must be a linear superposition of the, you know, of these states, right? So of the eigenstates of q. So basically, in this case, you can see that when q hat acting on this state will give you a whole sum over states. Unfortunately, what you see here is that a very large number of students, and these are, again, graduate students and advanced undergraduate students after a full year of Griffiths-level quantum mechanics from many different universities, they provided answers that says either they agree with Caroline or they agree with Andy or they agree with both. So only 46% of the students provide the correct answer here. In one-on-one interview, now you might say, oh, how can somebody agree with both of them, right? Because the thing is, somehow the left-hand side of the equation is the same, but the right-hand side is different. But actually, there's nothing to laugh about because you can see that measurement is a very difficult thing. And a lot of people, and since when we talk about measurement, we do tell students, you know, that measurement actually collapses the wave function. That is one thing we do tell them. We also say to students that after the measurement, the state of the system has become an eigenstate of the operator corresponding to the physical observables. And what you measure is an eigenvalue. So now the students are trying to put these things together and they are coming up with some model which is not correct, but there's nothing, you know, I don't think that there's, you know, these difficulties are something that we shouldn't expect. So this is pretty much expected, and what you, and it's more difficult than physics, than mathematics. So in a linear algebra course, if you ask students these questions about and say that, oh, this is not an eigenstate, can this happen? Can left-hand side like this suddenly turn into this? Nobody will make these kinds of mistakes because they are not thinking about any physical situation, and every student in physics who knows linear algebra will say, no, suddenly an operator q hat acting on this state will not give me, you know, just one term. So suddenly this term will not be equal to just one term, qn times psi n or something. The whole sum cannot just collapse to just one thing. It doesn't make any sense. But think about the students. You know, they are actually physically thinking about the situation. And they are thinking about what does measurement do to the system. So in that case, if they say, oh, suddenly this state collapses and all the terms go away and we are only getting one thing, it's not that surprising that students will say this. And those who actually agree with both, if you do one-on-one interview, what you find is that many of the students say, you know what, Andy is correct infinitesimally before the measurement, and Caroline is correct infinitesimally after, because then the measurement has already collapsed the state. And that's why after the collapse of the state, it becomes this. Before the collapse, it was that. So in physics, it's much more difficult for people to actually keep the two things together, especially when they are thinking through the situation in real time, and they are trying to, it's not that they are trying to think about the correctness of the linear algebra, which obviously is not correct in that situation. Anyway, in general, what we found is that the advanced students, regardless of which university they were from, had many common difficulties about quantum mechanics, independent of the textbook they had used, the teaching style, etc. And the commonality of these misconceptions originated from inability to discriminate between related things. So some of the ideas were correct in what they were saying, but somehow they were being overgeneralized in a certain way. So for example, when you say A psi is equal to E psi is always true, and people would often in written answers say, this is what 100 years of quantum mechanics has shown us. If experiments show anything else, I'll change my mind about it. You can see that you cannot blame the students because if that's what you are emphasizing in your course, only time-independent Schrodinger equation, which is not the most fundamental equation of quantum mechanics, it's the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, in the end, that's what students will remember. And that's what they are going to say is the most fundamental equation, right? So, again, they were making this generalization where they weren't discriminating between energy eigenstates and a linear superposition of energy eigenstates, for example, a general state of a quantum system. So how can we help students learn quantum mechanics better? Well, cognitive theory also says that you have to have activities that builds on students' knowledge and takes into account all of these difficulties that students are having in learning whatever, in this case, quantum mechanics. And the good thing is that student sense-making shows patterns, which means that students are not going to have 50 students will not have 50 different difficulties about time dependence of wave function or about quantum measurement or about other things, right? Okay, about measurement, another difficult thing, for example, for students is what happens to the quantum system after the measurement? Let's say after time t. You wait, what happens? What we have found is that many students say it goes back to the original state. You know, so if you were in a linear superposition of psi 1 and psi plus psi 2 and you did the measurement of energy, somehow people have this really fuzzy feeling about what happens after the measurement. They'll say, oh, it goes to psi 1 or psi 2 after the measurement. If you wait for a long time, it goes to that linear superposition after energy measurement. Or they might say, well, you know, after this, it's stuck in this state. Okay, for energy measurement, maybe it is stuck in the state, but not if you're doing position measurement or something else, but that's what people tend to think. So they have a very difficult time. Again, I want to point out that in some sense, measurement and time development in quantum mechanics is somewhat like that ballistic pendulum problem that I was telling you earlier about for introductory physics students. I was saying that that's a three-part problem. Something comes down, you have to use conservation of mechanical energy. Something gets stuck, you have to use momentum conservation. Something goes up, you have to use conservation of mechanical energy. It's a three-part problem, and for a new person, it's a very difficult thing. Similarly, in quantum mechanics, you are talking about, oh, the state is evolving according to time-dependent Schrodinger equation. Suddenly you do measurement, something totally different. Then suddenly the state again starts evolving according to time-dependent Schrodinger equation. You see, there are three parts to this, and putting them together, maybe as a faculty who's teaching quantum mechanics, for you it's obvious, and you're like, I've already taught this to students, they must have all understood it. But the point is, it's not clear to students, and again, it's a three-part problem where state evolves, measurement happens, and state evolves, and students are really struggling to put these three things together. Some are saying the state is always stuck in that state, even if it's like position measurement and, you know, state is stuck in delta function in position, or they are saying, oh no, it goes back to whatever was the original state. Both of these are incorrect answers, because after the measurement, the state again starts to evolve according to time-dependent Schrodinger equation. So these activities that we are actually developing is basically helping students in developing a coherent knowledge structure of quantum mechanics. That's what we do through these quantum interactive learning tutorials. You know, there's a lot of hint and feedback, and it's a guided approach to learning. It bridges the gap between qualitative and conceptual aspects, so it's not that you're compromising on the quantitative aspects. Those things are covered too, and students are actively engaged, because struggling is a good thing. If students have to think through things, that's a good thing, because anytime a person is struggling, they are actually beginning to learn things. So we have to always encourage our students to struggle, because that's the beginning and that's the seed of learning. So here I'm just giving you an example from a quilt or a quantum interactive learning tutorial on time development of wave function. And basically, in this particular thing, each of the quilts comes with a pretest and a post-test. So for example, I already showed you some examples in which you could see that one of the difficulties with time evolution of wave function is that people think that all of the states are stationary states, so time, the state will evolve just according to some overall phase factor, e to the power minus I e t over h bar, where sometimes people are not even clear what that E is, because in one interview, if you say, what is this E? If the state was not a stationary state, then sometimes people stop and say, that's something that I didn't think about. Maybe it's the expectation value or something. But the point is that if that's the common difficulty, then what the quilt starts out with is some pretest in which maybe, you know, some state will be stationary state and some will be a linear superposition, and they are asked to predict if the probability densities in these cases will depend upon time or not. And if they said, oh, in both of these cases, the probability density doesn't depend on time, in one case it's true, in the case of stationary state, in the case of non-stationary state, it's not true, then in the quilt, they start out by checking their prediction with a simulation. You know, so they actually look at the non-stationary state, for example, this one, and what they will see, this is the probability density and this is position, and what they see is that at this moment, and I'm showing you a static graph, but people actually see the simulation itself, so what they'll see is that at different times, the probability density looks very different when you are starting out with this linear superposition. At this point, according to Piagetian framework, you have actually created a state of disequilibrium, because student says, oh, I predicted something wrong in the pretest, so what was wrong in my thinking? So at that point, the rest of the tutorial will help the students think about why is it that the eigenstates of Hamiltonian are special when it comes to issues related to time dependence of wave function, you know, because Hamiltonian governs the time evolution of the system according to the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, and hence, when you are not in a stationary state, why you should think about writing the state as a linear superposition and how different you know, terms here will actually evolve according to different time-dependent phase factors, right? And so then they can actually understand this thing better, and maybe in the quilt at some point there is also a, you know, flow chart to help students summarize the cases, the discrete and the continuous eigenvalue spectrum cases. And then students actually do some post-tests in which they have to actually do these things themselves without help. Because an important thing is that students at some point have to develop self-reliance. Moreover, students have to actually be given an opportunity to do the same thing in many different contexts. This is very important because, you know, for you, something may be context independent because you have become an expert in that. But for students, it's not immediately obvious. And you may even see students in quantum mechanics, if you only did some examples of time independence in the context of infinite square well, one-dimensional infinite square well, and you didn't do it for harmonic oscillator potential energy, then it's possible that if you say to students, oh, here is a linear superposition of ground state and first excited state for harmonic oscillator, and you said, what is the state after time t? One student or two students will always say to you, this was not covered in the class because you only did time dependence for infinite square well. And for you, it's the same question. So it's really important that you give students an opportunity to see that how you find the state after time t is the same, regardless of which problem you're looking at. You know, and this, so context, you know, having students generalize across different contexts and see that the same concept applies across different contexts is really important. Just like in introductory physics, you know, if you do a problem with ballerina putting her arms close to herself and putting it out, and then in the exam you say a neutron star is collapsing under its own gravitational force, you know, there are no external torques or anything on this system, you know, how much is the speed of this thing after the radius has gone from this to this, the student might say, this was an introductory physics course, how is the neutron star coming into picture here, right? No, seriously, I mean, and you may say, oh my God, didn't I just give exactly the same thing in class and here? For students, these are two different contexts. And so unless the student actually sees the same problem in many different contexts and is given an opportunity to generalize and see, you know, maybe you have another problem in which somebody is diving from a diving board, and you have to ask them, you know, when the person puts their body close to themselves and tucks themselves into a ball versus when they put their arms out, you know, how does it affect their angular speed and why? If they see that across these different contexts, the same principle is being used, and maybe you can even ask them to come up with some of their own contexts. That's even better. And quilts actually do that. They actually, towards the end, tell students to come up with some situations where they might have to design, for example, their own Stern-Gerlach experiment that actually you know, shows certain things. You know, maybe it shows how spin up, if you start out with spin up, you end up with spin down. You have prepared a quantum state that is spin down. Or maybe you have done some Mach-Zehnder interferometer experiment, quilt in which students actually start out with some examples of quantum eraser, how you can inform, you know, get rid of which path information when you had it in the beginning. And then maybe you can have students come up with other situations in which, you know, you can erase the information, which path information, before the photon or something arrives at the screen. So I think, you know, it's a good idea to give students examples in different contexts and then have them come up with their own, in their own group, examples of things. And so we have different, many different, of the order of 15 quilts. And you can see that students' pretest score, by pretest I mean after traditional instruction in quantum mechanics, is much lower than their post-test score after the quilt. So basically between these things is quilt, and pretest means after traditional instruction in these topics. We are also developing peer instruction tools, and by peer instruction tools, I mean two things. You know, one is concept tests, you know, clicker questions for quantum mechanics, and we have of the order of 500 clicker questions that covers a full semester of Griffith-level quantum mechanics, so if anybody is interested, we'll be delighted to send it to you. We, in addition, also have these just-in-time teaching tools, which is basically reflective problems. So these are questions that actually help students exercise different parts of their brain. So they are conceptual questions that will be good questions to supplement the traditional textbook problems, which are more quantitative in nature. So these things will say, you know, why do you think this is the case? You know, so for example, one misconception students might have is that if an electron is initially in an eigenstate of S of X, then the expectation value of S of X is time independent, even if the Hamiltonian depends on S of Z, because the magnetic field is applied in the Z direction. So in through these conceptual questions, you can force students to think through these issues and why that is the case, right? Because if you're thinking about time dependence of expectation value, you know, unless the some physical observable happens to be constant of motion, because it, the operator corresponding to it commutes with the Hamiltonian, only if you're in stationary state will the expectation values be time independent, right? So, but people often think, oh, if something is in an eigenstate of Sx, then the expectation value of Sx should be time independent. Or they might think, if something is zero in the initial state, then the expectation value is time independent, because they think that if something is zero in the initial state, then the thing is stuck there. It cannot change from zero. And that's not the case. It's like saying, if the velocity is zero in the initial state, then the rate of change of velocity will be zero too. If that were true, then your car will never be able to get out of the garage, right? But the point is that same kind of thing happens in quantum mechanics too. People think if the expectation value is zero in the initial state, how can the expectation value have a time dependence, right? So this issue of, you know, what is there, what is true in the initial state, and how something evolves in time, how the state evolves in time, is a difficult one. And these just-in-time teaching questions can be used either as questions that you can give to students at the beginning that they can answer on CourseWeb, upload it through CourseWeb, or you can even give it as supplement to your homework. So you can use it in different ways. When I say just-in-time teaching, I'm thinking about you actually giving it ahead of time to students, where they read the book, they try to answer these questions, and then you discuss these things in class. That would be one way of doing it, but you don't have to. You can just give it as supplement to the homework, and that would be a good thing too. By the way, many of these concept tests can also be used as review questions at the beginning or end of the lecture. So, you know, you shouldn't be actually doing the review for the student in a class and saying, oh, yesterday we learned about, you know, this particular topic. Instead of that, you can say, okay, yesterday we were talking about Larmor precession of spin, and you know, there were lots of nice issues you learned about time dependence of expectation value in that particular context. Here are some 5 concept tests related to it. Why don't you talk to a person next to you? And all of those questions will summarize for students and help them think through with their own partner about, you know, those things that were learned in the last class. Because if you are summarizing it for them, then you are the person who's learning, not your students, right? Okay, so I already, you know, went over the fact that students actually can learn a lot from each other. I am not talking about some of the other research studies that I've done in introductory physics related to peer instruction. I am a big supporter of peer instruction at all level. Even at the introductory level, what we have found is that in 29% of the cases, if students do something in pretest, which is wrong, 2 students do it wrong, and you put them together, you say to students, okay, why don't you pair up with another person, start thinking about this particular issue? And what you find is that after that, if you have students take individual quizzes, 29% of the time, students actually get those things right, even without any intervention from the student. In other words, students can co-construct knowledge by talking to each other. They can actually have very productive discussions where they can say, you know, I'm not clear about this, you know, can you think about this? And, you know, oh, and these are not topics that are really easy. These are issues related to, you know, how does the potential difference relate to electric field? How does the work done, you know, by the electric force, you know, depend upon, say, potential difference and things like that, you know? So pretty complicated topics in introductory physics that students actually can do with each other much better, and after that they show great improvement in post-test, even despite the fact that the instructor was never involved. So I actually encourage you to involve your students in the learning process at all times. Also, there is enough research to show that students actually benefit from this regardless of the fact that, you know, they might be already really good at something. So in other words, the process of explaining something to somebody else is a good thing for all students, regardless of what their status is. So it's not true that, oh, this is a star student, he'll be completely bored. No. In that case, maybe it's possible that they are actually pretty much trying to teach their peer. But even that process is helpful, not just to the person that they're teaching, but to themselves also, because the process of articulating your thoughts is a very good thing too. By the way, here is just one example that I'm giving you from my own research, where we are seeing that, you know, related to topics on infinite square well, Here, for 4 consecutive years, we have been trying to monitor how the students are doing in this class. This is the score out of 10 versus percentage of students. And you can see without concept test, students were not doing as well. This is the distribution, this black thing. With concept test and with modified concept test and with further modified concept test, we keep seeing some improvement. Now it's pretty much plateauing out. The averages at least look pretty similar. So at this point, we know that our concept tests are looking pretty good because we keep tweaking the concept test after administration, after we see that students still might have difficulty with certain issues or the other. Okay, this is students' performance on quantum measurement. This is after traditional instruction on this topic. You can see students perform pretty poorly on post-tests related to quantum measurement. Here with concept tests only, their performance is significantly better. If you use concept tests and Quilt, it's even better. If anybody is interested in these Quilts, I'll be happy to send it. We have also developed a standardized survey, which is called Quantum Mechanics Survey, which is a 31-question survey. And we have tested the reliability and validity. This is in American Journal of Physics and last year. And again, what we find is that if you use these research-based learning tools, student performance on this survey is close to 70%, which is significantly better than student performance otherwise. And these things are averages across the country. So we have data from like at least 7-8 universities, if not more. Let's see. Okay. Do I have a little bit of more time? Okay, so I wanted to give just a couple more examples just to tell you that if you are saying, you know, I was in quantum mechanics course, you know, a long time ago, and I didn't need any of these learning tools, why do I have to do anything different in these upper level courses? One thing that I want to tell you is that the diversity in our classes has increased, because why people major in physics is not necessarily exactly the same reason as why you were a physics major. So people come with very different backgrounds, very different preparations. And even in these advanced courses, you would see that the diversity is pretty large now. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples from our own research. And so one of the things is, do students reflect on their mistakes on their own without any prodding by the instructor? Okay. In order to do this, you know, you would think that if you post the solutions to midterm exams, students might themselves actually look through the solutions and say, oh yeah, I made this mistake, I should never make this mistake again, right? And people would take the opportunity to organize their knowledge. So basically, we wanted to see how students do. And so this was in a quantum mechanics course, and what we did was we gave 4 problems to students in the final exam, 2 of which were from, so, 2 each from each of the midterm exams. And we wanted to see, do students improve on the final exam compared to the midterm exams? And what we found is that students' average performance on those 4 problems in midterm exam or final exam was not very different. You can see this is the midterm performance on problem 1, this is final exam, midterm final exam, midterm final exam. So it's not, and overall you can see it's pretty much the same. Of course, one of the problems was really easy, this problem. And we deliberately picked problems that were, you know, of different difficulty. So you can see this is a hard problem, this is a really easy problem. So you can see that the students who actually improve, and also if you look at individual students, there were students who went to from, you know, bad to good, so they performed much better. But then there were also students who stayed, who didn't perform well either time, or even, you know, went down. So for example, this is one example where the student didn't do well in the final exam, where the student had done perfectly well in the midterm exam. The question was asking, okay, write down the expectation value of Q in some state psi in terms of eigenstates and eigenvalue of Q, okay? And the correct answer here is that it's basically sum over the eigenvalues times the probability of measuring those things, okay? This is the midterm performance. The student is getting 100%. Here, the same student is doing this for the same problem. You can see, if you look carefully, you'll see it says HQ minus QH. It looks like the student has some, you know, confusion between what this question is asking and maybe time dependence of expectation value, because in those things, you know, you start developing this kind of HQ minus QH if you actually try to look at D over DT of that. But anyway, the point is that in midterm, the student knew what he or she was doing, but here, the student doesn't, right? It's the same exact student. How is this possible? Well, we also interviewed 6 of these students, right? In the second semester of quantum mechanics course, this is the Griffith level course, and what we found is that some students explicitly say that they don't like to look at the instructor solution in midterm exam. This is when the instructor solutions are posted. For all of these midterms, the instructor solutions are posted, right? So one student says they don't expect those questions to be repeated in the final exam. They were surprised that the same question showed up. And another student says, for example, it pains him to realize that they have done poorly. So they don't look at the solution. Well, what am I trying to say here? One thing that I'm going to say is that since I'm running out of time, I want to say that it is not a bad idea, for example, even in these advanced courses, since we have such a diverse student population, to say, you know, please correct your midterm exam maybe for 50% of the credit. You know, I'll give you, if you got like 60%, I'll give you up to 20% more, you know, so maybe we'll make it 80 if you return to me all of the corrected things or something. That's a really good strategy because then students will be forced to correct their thing. You can also tell them to maybe think about how all of these things are organized in a knowledge structure. Make them come up with some kind of knowledge structure diagram of quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics may be non-intuitive, but it definitely has a very well-defined knowledge structure. And it shouldn't be that students are thinking through it as chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, just like in introductory physics. Even there, we should really force, you know, give students opportunity to build a knowledge structure. So if you tell them to actually come up with a flow chart or a diagram that shows the connections between different things that they have learned, that would be a great thing to do. I also wanted to actually point out another study that we did, which was published in 2010, in which what we found, we asked students to categorize quantum mechanics problems. When I say categorizing, what I mean is we gave them several problems, and we asked them to group them together based upon how you would solve it. So, for example, all of the problems that were on quantum measurement, we expected them to group them together. All the problems related to time dependence of wave function, we wanted them to group them together, etc. Now, this thing was not just given to students in these upper-level courses, but it was also given to physics professors who teach quantum mechanics. Okay, so they had to do the same thing. And then we jumbled up all of these things, and we asked some other professors to score these things on a scale of maybe 0 to 3, or I forgot whether it's 2 to 6 or something like that, but we asked them to grade it on a rubric. And so they didn't know which one was professors' responses, which one was students' responses. And then we tried to see what was the total score that all of these people got. By the way, this particular kind of study was inspired by some study that has been done in introductory physics, in which what people have found is that introductory physics students, when they are asked to categorize or group problems together based upon similarity of solution, they often, for example, might put all the problems involving inclined plane in one category and all the problems that involve pulleys in one category, or, you know, all the problems involving spring in one category, as opposed to grouping them based upon conservation of mechanical energy, conservation of momentum, conservation of, you know, angular momentum, etc., or Newton's second law, that kind of thing. So here is the performance of students versus faculty. The white one is faculty and black is student. Here is their average score out of 6. Here is percentage of people. And here is percentage of problems with a score of 50% or better. And you can see that even though faculty didn't know whose thing they were grading, they obviously graded faculty's categorization much better. Although you can see that there's slight disagreement here, even amongst faculty, because what we but what I really want to point your attention to is that students are all over the place. So there are students who are really good, they are as good as faculty, and then there are students who are here. So you can see that even in these upper-level courses, there is a great diversity in student preparation, and if we really help all of these students learn quantum mechanics better, that would obviously be the best thing, right? But I also want to say why there was some disagreement in terms of faculty themselves. You know, so what we found in one-on-one interview with some of these faculty members who had done the categorization task, grouping of these problems into things, you know, for example, if the problem, even if it was about time dependence of wave function or about measurement, if somebody categorized it as a hydrogen atom problem or a harmonic oscillator problem, somehow they love these two categories so much. Even though it seems like, you know, these are not really deep features, you know, they just like quantum, you know, hydrogen atom. This is so, you know, quintessential to quantum mechanics. I just don't feel really bad about, you know, not giving a student or anybody else point if they wrote hydrogen atom as their category. You see what I'm saying? So it was not as clear-cut as introductory physics, because in introductory physics, you see that all the professors are always in, you know, the highest category. So there was some disagreement, but not as much as you would expect, and you can see that the upper-level students are all over the place, which means that we really need to think about helping all students learn. So in summary, research shows that advanced undergraduate and graduate students have common difficulties, which are universal, independent of the school teaching style and textbook, and they don't necessarily take the time automatically to learn from their mistakes, so we have to give them the opportunity. And also, we are developing these learning tools that actually help students learn physics better. So as I said, these tools help students bridge the gap between conceptual and quantitative aspects. They use computer simulations, and students, they, you know, are rewarded for trying to merge the quantitative and conceptual understanding of quantum mechanics. So I'll take any questions at this point. Thank you so much.